Hi, and welcome to Recovery Internet Radio and our show, Straight Stuff on Addictions. Tonight, our tag is Addiction Treatment, an International Perspective. I'd like to welcome Dr. Elizabeth Nyang. And how are you this evening, Elizabeth?
Well, I'm doing well, thank you.
I'm glad to hear it, and thanks for coming on. I really appreciate it. I know we had talked a little bit beforehand, and you told me that you were a listener, that you tuned into the show.
Yes, I do.
And that's great. I love that. It's always great for us to hear that because we don't always know where our listeners are coming from. Now we know where you are. You're in Maryland.
Yep, so, I'm in Maryland. Yeah.
Yeah. So let me just ask you. We'll just get going here. I'm interested to know a little bit about what you do. I know you're a private practice person, and you also work for the county. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I can give you just like a little bit of history about me.
Sure.
I worked in the public sector for 23 years, and my first master's degree was in library and information systems.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a lot of volunteer work with at-risk youth and decided that when I retired, I wanted to go back to school and change careers.
Mm-hmm.
So I started planning and 2 years before I retired, I went back to school and started working on my counseling degree.
Mm-hmm.
And after I got my counseling degree, I went on and got my doctorate and completed that program in 2008. And when I was working on my master's, I did my practicum at an intensive outpatient program for clients with addictions.
Okay.
And I did my internship at the county jail here. And I also did part of my internship at the pre-release center here, which is where you complete the last 6 months to 12 months of your sentence. And so that's where I really started my work with clients with addictions during my practicum and internship.
So you were working quite a bit with offenders.
Yes, I was.
Yeah, that's a pretty long stretch from library science to working with offenders, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
That's great. I love that. I have contact with lots of social service people, and that's a story that's one that I hadn't heard. That's a good one. That's a good one for sure. Where did you get your doctorate?
American School of Professional Psychology at Argosy University.
Okay, great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, and now you're in Montgomery County, is that right?
That's right. Silver Spring, Maryland is in Montgomery County.
Mm-hmm. You have a private practice and you also work for the county, is that right?
Yes, I have a private practice. It's a small private practice, and then I have a contract with the county. That's the biggest part of what I do. So I work with clients that have mental illness, primarily mood disorders, anxiety disorder, bipolar disorder, and depression. And then I work with the clients that I receive from the county. And they have alcohol and other substance abuse issues.
Okay.
Most of the clients I work with are between, they're between the ages of 19 and 65, and most of them are between 19 and 25.
And that's pretty predictable age range-wise for the 18 to 25 or 19 to 25 to be the bulk of the substance abuse population?
But I think it is.
Yeah, that would be my experience here, you know, from our end. So tell me what kind of substance abuse clients that do you see? I mean, what are you know, we talked a little bit about this last night. I know you mentioned a lot of them are marijuana related cases.
Yes.
What else do you see?
Heroin, alcohol, crack, cocaine. Prescription medications, PCP.
Okay. And these are all, so these folks are these court ordered to treatment?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Most of my clients are court ordered into treatment. Some come voluntarily, but most of them are court ordered. So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Do you do groups or do you see them individually or both or how do you
work? I do both. Yeah, I do both, groups and individual.
Okay. And when you do, so tell me a little bit about your group work process. What's that like? I know you mentioned you do level one work.
Right.
These are probably offenders but non-addicts mostly?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. What kind of stuff do you do? Is it educational or is it?
It's psychoeducational, so we do some education, and then we do a lot of it. It's CBT focused.
Okay.
So we always have an exercise that we use with the clients because we find that that keeps them focused.
I would see that would be a good thing. Say just a little bit about what CBT is, so for who are listening who might not know.
Of the cognitive behavioral therapy approach where we try to get them to change their thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to work with them. A lot of them have very negative thinking patterns, and so we try to work with them to convert or change that negative thought into a positive thought.
Okay.
We try to get them to focus on changing behaviors and people, places, and things, and we try to get them to look at the world a little bit differently. So we've used Tai Chi with our clients. We've used meditation with our clients. We have a Buddha singing bowl that we use with them. We've done some walking Tai Chi and walking meditation.
Mm-hmm.
We also do exercises to help them look at their life skills or build coping skills and build life skills.
Do you have some experience yourself with Buddhist tradition?
I went to a local Buddhist temple here mm-hmm. and studied meditation for a year with them. So that's where I learned sitting meditation and walking meditation.
Well, that's great because you have some experience of your own to bring to the group then.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, that's good. That's good to know. So, but there are, as I understand it, there's two other levels of groups or treatment going on at the same time, or these are the more severe cases, or.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't work with the more severe cases, but I do give referrals so that the clients, if they need a higher level of care, pretty much if they're relapsing, they can't maintain their sobriety, then I refer them to a higher level of care,
mm-hmm.
and I refer them to an intensive outpatient program where they would have to go for 4 days a week, more than 9 hours of treatment,
mm-hmm.
or an inpatient program where they probably are going to be there for 28 days. If they need detox, they would get 3 days of detox, and then they would get 25 days of treatment.
I got you. And are most of these people, are some of them or most of them, or I guess what percentage of them are indigent or homeless?
Most of them.
Okay, so...
Yeah, yeah,
a majority, a vast majority of them. How is that working with people that are poor and don't have financial resources? Because you work in a private practice where I'm sure you're working with people that do have resources.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What's the difference?
Well, I think the primary difference is the resistance. And this has nothing to do with the poverty. They just don't believe that they need to be in treatment. But if you take the resistance away, there really isn't that much difference because I just see a person that needs help.
Mm-hmm.
I see a person that finds it very difficult to believe that they have a mental illness and an addiction because some of my clients are co-occurring.
Mm-hmm.
or have, I see people that are just in denial about having an addiction, and you know, they're just in denial that yes, I have blackouts and I drink a lot, but I can get it under control. You know, I don't really need to be here. I can control it myself. And I hear that from clients that have six-figure salaries, or I mean, you know, have like a lot of money, or clients that have no money.
So I take it then that alcoholism is an equal opportunity disease.
Yes, yeah. And so is cocaine.
So any of it, right?
Yeah, heroin, yeah.
Or mental illness, I guess, huh?
Or mental illness, yes.
Which kind of is a good segue into my next question, which is really, I mean, I know I'm asking for an opinion or your opinion about something that you maybe you have some experience with, but we've talked about how you've been to India to see what they do there. And
mm-hmm.
I just wondered, looking at the way what you know about the way other countries do treatment, what do you think, or how would you rate how we do substance abuse treatment here in the U.S.?
I think it's probably going to vary from state to state,
mm-hmm.
and I think there are going to be different levels of resources available from state to state.
Mm-hmm.
And when I did my doctoral research, the topic of the thesis was on registered nurses' perceptions of what influences the treatment of psychiatric patients in the emergency department.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that, the study. I interviewed nurses in New Jersey, North Carolina, and Maryland. I did one in Pennsylvania, but she didn't want to be in the study. And what I found was that in the more rural communities, and it's also the same here in Maryland, you really don't have the availability of staff to work with the clients, like to recognize mental illness or substance abuse in the emergency department.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're probably in those rural communities, very little opportunity to get placed into a psychiatric facility or into a inpatient psychiatric substance abuse treatment facility, because they don't have that there. Maybe they don't have that level of service there. So sometimes people have to travel a long distance to get the services that they need, or in other instances, they had the clinician travel around to more than one hospital.
In the rural areas, yeah. Do you think that, so in the rural areas of this country, it's more similar to what you find in other countries?
Well, I think in terms of not having the staff available, I think that's a similarity.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we probably have more access to treatment here than in other, like in India, for example. They just didn't have the trained staff.
Mm-hmm. They just don't exist.
And so they had hospitals in major metropolitan areas, but in the rural areas, they just didn't exist at all.
Mm-hmm.
So they were trying to train paraprofessionals to go out into the community, and in some instances, knocking door, going to the door to give treatment for addictions. Because of the stigma, and because people just weren't in any condition to go out and get the treatment.
I see. You told me a story when I was asking you about the conditions in India, and I want to. Well, yeah, I'll ask you this first, and then I'm going to back into another question. But you told me a story in order to help me understand what an inpatient setting might look like in India, and you told me about a place in, I believe it was Pennsylvania, called Byberry. Can you tell me that story?
Yes. Byberry, for me, every time I think about Byberry, I think about deinstitutionalization in the United States. It was one of those very large mental health asylums. That's what they were called. They were called mental health asylums. And this one was right outside of Philadelphia. I think every state had one or more than one of them.
Yeah.
And they're huge facilities, and people would do farming and different things at these different facilities. But the treatment wasn't good at all. And so during World War II, the Byberry was opened in 1907, and then in the 1940s, it became part of the Pennsylvania health or hospital system. And so during World War II, the conscientious objectors were placed in these different asylums in different states. And there are lots of Quakers in Philadelphia, because it was founded by William Penn. He's a Quaker.
Yep.
And this hospital is right outside of Philadelphia. So when they got to the hospital and they saw the conditions, they were just appalled by the conditions. And so one of the Quakers, his name was Charlie Lord, he smuggled in a camera and he took some pictures. And then he started showing these pictures to different officials because he was trying to get changes made in the state, in that hospital. And so eventually there was an investigation, and Life magazine went in. They used his pictures. I don't know if they took additional pictures. But if you Google Byberry Hospital, you'll see a lot of information and pictures of how patients were treated.
And your perception was that the conditions at Byberry at that time were similar to what you saw when you went to India.
Well, when I went to India, I went to the Institute of Human Behavior and Allied Sciences in Delhi.
Yes.
And they had a facility that, the facility was really pretty well run and pretty well managed, but they had kept the part, like the old part where they used to house their patients.
Yes.
During
yes.
the early 1900s, and it was very similar.
I see. It, so the old yeah, part, it, yeah.
Okay. Yes, it just and it was kind of like a museum part. They would give you a tour of it.
So you could see their progress then.
Yes, I could see their progress.
So the question. Well, go ahead.
I was going to say at that particular facility, they did have an addictions program. They had 20 of the 260 beds at that hospital was reserved for people with addictions.
Okay.
And then they had an addiction specialty program where people came two times a week. I think it was Monday and Wednesday for groups like AA and NA and support groups, people with addictions.
So that's interesting. So they do have support groups there. The question I wanted to back into here was, so we're talking about you going to India, and we're talking in particular here about this facility in Delhi. But what took you to India? What made you want to go there, and how did you get there, and what was that process?
Well, there's a group that I had traveled to China with, and it's called People to People Ambassador Program. And what they do, they have educational, kind of like exchange programs where they take professionals from the United States to different countries. And there was I looked at their website, there was a program for mental health.
Mm-hmm.
And it was psychiatrists. And at first I thought, well, you know, I'm not really a psychiatrist. I don't know if I would feel comfortable around them. I'm not a medical doctor. But then I decided I really wanted to go and learn about mental health and addictions in India. I had read a lot about how they use meditation with people with mental illness there, and that whole mind-body connection. And I wanted to learn about that. So I decided to sign up for it, and they do very short trips because they say that professionals don't have a lot of time to take away from work. Mm-hmm. But what I like about it is that they do sightseeing, and you go to lots of like facilities and have meetings with other professionals.
So that's what you got to do. Do you remember, and I'm sure you do, what it was like for you when you got off the airplane? Did you get off the airplane in Delhi?
Yes.
Yeah, what was that like for you when you stepped off the airplane?
For me, it was fine. Well, first of all, it was really late at night. Mm-hmm. But when we went to Old Delhi, everybody else on the trip, they were kind of like in culture shock because you have all of these people, these real short, like very, very narrow streets, and it's just like, Everywhere you look, there's nothing but people, and people look very different. They're dressed differently, and you don't know the language. But I had lived in the Middle East when I was married for 3 years, and that's what it was like when I went shopping.
Okay, so you weren't that shocked.
No, I wasn't that shocked.
Where did you live in the Middle East?
In Jeddah.
Oh, okay. Okay, so you had a little experience with that. That's
yeah.
That's something. What cities did you visit in India?
I went to Jaipur. I'm going to turn my cell phone off. I'm sorry. I went to Jaipur, and I went to Agra and Delhi.
Okay. And can you give us a geographical, like where in the country those cities are, north to south, for instance?
They're north.
They're all northern cities?
They're all northern cities.
Okay. And are they all relatively modern cities?
Yes, they're all modern cities.
Okay, so you talked a little bit earlier about the stigma of what the judgment level was like towards people with mental illness and substance abuse in India. What can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. At one of the hospitals, they told us that some people don't want to go to the hospital or to a clinic or receive services because of the stigma, because everybody would know. You know, they live in these rural communities, and everybody knows everybody. And so if there's a clinic and you go, everybody's going to know why you're there. And that's why they're moving towards going to in-home counseling for people, because then people would know what services you're getting. They also said, one of the doctors also said that a lot of people believe in traditional medicine, and so they are moving toward. They're moving towards. Sorry about that.
Okay.
They're moving towards. I can't remember what I was going to say now.
They're moving towards more in-home counseling, or people going to the rural areas rather than the rural areas.
Right.
Right,
they're moving towards more in-home counseling, because then you wouldn't know what service they are receiving. Now, a lot of people still go to the traditional healers. Okay, a lot of people still go to the traditional healers,
okay.
And they said that unfortunately sometimes they would hit them on the head with something to knock the mental illness out. They also use herbs and other potions and things to help people. And there are some traditional healers that are now telling people to go to the mental health clinic.
Okay. And so Do you think that there's any of the traditional healers that are in any way helpful?
Yes, I think traditional healers are always helpful because people believe in them. Mm-hmm. And I think that the remedies that they've been using for years, some of them might be harmful, but I think there's some that aren't harmful. I know that when I worked and I did some work on the U.S. government's HIV/AIDS program, mm-hmm. and one of the things they did in Brazil, this was years ago, they would take the condoms to the traditional healers, and they would bless the condoms. They also did that in Africa, and that got people to use the condoms. Mm-hmm. So I think there are so many people that believe in the traditional healers, and that when you train the traditional healers to recognize certain symptoms of addiction or mental illness, that they can't do anything to relieve those symptoms, then they are now telling those people to go to the mental health clinic.
So it's traditional medicine or traditional healing working in cooperation with, rather
yeah.
than as opposed to. What is the attitude? When we talk about stigma, what would it be? What would people think if somebody were getting help for a mental illness? What would the stigma be? That they were weak, or that they were? What would it be?
Well, they didn't go into specifics of what the stigma would actually be, mm-hmm. but it was kind of like obvious that they would be perceived. People would be perceived as being different.
Okay.
And they also talked about there was legal complications, because if your family could prove that you were mentally ill, then they could take you to court and you could lose everything, your house, your inheritance, you could lose everything if the court system decided that you were mentally ill. And for some people, they didn't want to lose everything. So
that makes sense. And in a society where the structure is not like our structure, that
right.
those kinds of things could be a lot more important.
Right.
I wonder what an effective, and I don't know if you can answer this, but the thought that I have in my mind is, I wonder what the attitude or I wonder what a traditional healer, how I wonder what they see when we see somebody who's mentally ill,
mm-hmm.
what do they see? I mean, mental illness is a relatively new concept in that culture. So I wonder what they see.
Yeah, that part I don't know.
I'd probably have to ask a traditional Indian healer.
You'd have to ask a traditional Indian healer.
and you're English, sorry. I mean, you're American, so that's not going to work. Okay.
That's right.
Just a thought. Anyway, let me ask you another question. Is there in the treatment that you saw in India that is being currently provided through the clinics, is there a cultural is it culturally different than what we would do?
Yes. One of the things that was noticeable was that the person that went to the hospital, the whole family went to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's great to have that kind of support from your family, but then it was very difficult to discuss the illness with a family member because of what we would consider to be HIPAA requirements.
A room full of people.
Exactly. So they said that they tried to protect the client, but sometimes the family members would pull the doctor aside and want to discuss the case. And so there was a lot of that where you weren't just consulting with the person with the illness, you were consulting with the whole family.
How did they handle that? I mean, was that just a given that that was probably going to happen, so you just went with it, or?
Yeah, pretty much, because they even they stay at the hospital and they sleep in the room, at least one person, maybe not the whole family, but at least one person, and then they would also become like that palliative care. You know, they gave the care to the person in the hospital too. So they were very much involved with the treatment.
What did you think about that?
Well, I thought that from a cultural perspective that that's probably just the way it is. I mean, I could see where sometimes I'll have see a family and one member of the family just wants to talk and talk and talk and not, you know, I really can't hear from the client. And even if I say, well, you know, do you want to just give me a couple of minutes to talk together? They're so intimidated, you know, sometimes they'll say no, and you just get that family member's perspective. So it's hard to sort out what's actually happening with the client. It takes longer.
Yeah, I can see where it would. And it also seems like there's a level of nurturing from the family there culturally that maybe we don't have as much of here, or we just mm-hmm. understand it. When we take somebody to the hospital, we expect that the hospital's going to take care of them.
Right.
Where that's not always the expectation there.
Well, you know, they just may not know what to expect, but they're not going anywhere.
That's pretty good.
That's the question I got.
Okay. So let me ask you another one. Did you find that there was a spiritual component to the treatment that we don't find here? Or can you speak to that a little bit?
Well, I just got the sense that there was, because they talked about all these different religions that they have in India and how tolerant they are of all these different religions that they have there. And so even in shops, you would see like these gods that people would pay respect to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I did notice that there was a lot of that.
Mm-hmm. The spirituality is kind of a little bit more embedded in the culture maybe than it is here. Is that
yes.
a fair
mm-hmm.
way to say it? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So if it's embedded in the culture, it's going to be embedded in the treatment. We would.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So when we are talking about substance abuse in the U.S., we've talked about the substances that you've seen and you've treated here in the U.S. What were they primarily treating there in India?
Well, it was alcohol, and it was heroin and marijuana.
Okay.
Those were the three that I remember. Now, the clinic that I visited, that one really, that first one that we went to, the Institute of Human Behavioral and Allied Sciences,
yes.
that was really the only one that talked about its addictions program. But and I asked them about medication, and they did give out Suboxone.
Oh, they did for the opiate addiction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they said that most of the patients that come in, they are treated on an outpatient basis. And at that particular facility, there were about 950 people that went to that hospital a day.
Wow.
Which is a lot of people. So they, and I think there may have been like 250 new patients within that 950 number.
Per day.
Mm-hmm. And so they said that most of them come in, they get the treatment, and then they go back out to their community. Now, within the community, they have, I don't know if they're called pharmacies, but they take their prescription back out to the community, and then they get their medications there because there's no clinic and there's no hospital there.
So they get them. They do not get them in the community that they go back to.
They do. Prescriptions, yes.
I see.
But no follow-up.
Okay.
Treatment, yeah.
No follow-up. So 950 people a day, 250 of them new patients. So, and how many doctors?
Oh, there weren't many doctors at all. Maybe three or four.
Okay. So, yeah, that's a pretty good sized caseload. That would probably make most American doctors faint right on the spot. Just to hear you say that.
Yeah.
Do they have, so you didn't see, there's not inpatient treatment for addiction anywhere you really saw?
Well, yes, they had the 20 beds.
Oh, they did. That was inpatient for substance
abuse. Yeah. Right. They had 20 of the 260 beds that was for inpatient treatment.
Okay. And I wonder, I mean, did you get a sense of how they decided who would require inpatient and who did not?
No, I didn't. They didn't really go over that a lot. It was like they were kind of vague about it.
Mm-hmm.
And in reading about it, because I had read about it, I knew that they did have a very large program in India, although it was a new program in India. And it's a community-based treatment program where they have a clinic and they give out methadone. And I know that it's all new, but they do. And they had one, it's called the National Drug Dependence Treatment Center.
Mm-hmm.
And they had like a clinic in New Delhi and maybe three or four other places in India where they do methadone treatment. And they do detox, outpatient detox,
mm-hmm.
and they did some inpatient detox. But so I did know that it existed, but not at the facilities where we went.
And I know we had talked about you mentioned the word follow up, and we had talked about follow up because I know that was an interest of yours, and
mm-hmm.
it doesn't seem like it would be very easy for there to be follow-up in this setup.
No, it doesn't, because 950 a day, let's just say round up to 1,000 a day, that's 7,000 if they, well 5,000 because they would be closed on Saturday and Sunday. So when would you have time to do a follow-up?
On 5,000 people.
Yes.
Yeah, and it sounds like they do have some support groups, but not a big system. In this country, there's thousands of 12-step groups and other kinds of support groups for addictions and mental health all over the country. But there, it doesn't sound like they're very prevalent.
Right. And it could have been the people that we were interviewing.
Mm-hmm.
But even from what I've read about the other other drug treatment in India, it's there, but I wasn't sure how big it was. Now, they do have some very, very large hospital that was primarily for, physical problems and maybe some mental health problems, maybe some addictions, but I just wasn't really sure how big their, let's call it, national substance abuse program was.
And I wonder, I'm a substance abuse treatment professional, so I understand the concept that addiction is a disease, and we've already talked about the fact that it doesn't discriminate, as far as socioeconomic class is concerned, and I don't suspect that it discriminates based on race or religion either. So
right.
I guess I'm wondering, if there's just as many alcoholics and addicts in India as there are in the U.S., and they have, I don't know what the population of India is, but it's considerably
very high.
Yeah, considerably bigger than the U.S.
Yes.
A lot of people, that's a lot of suffering people.
That's a lot of suffering. Yeah, I agree. That's a lot of suffering people. And the concern I had was that if you were getting any sort of a psychotropic medication, because you go there, they give you the treatment, and it's very short term, and then you go back home and they have that pharmacy back there. You know, I just wonder if you have all of these people that are now taking these psychotropic medications that they get when they make that long trip into the major city to get their help, and like what's happening out in the rural areas, or what could possibly happen with all of these people now that are going to be taking these medications?
Yeah, with what would appear to be very limited supervision, and what it makes me wonder is, I mean, I know how it works here. I know how you would want to stay right on top of a person with an addictions problem, especially if they were using medication.
Yes.
But what I don't know is the thinking the same in India as it is here? Is their culture such that they view we kid around that, how do you know when an addict is lying, when they open their mouth? Does that apply in India? Or I don't know, and I really wonder about that.
Yeah, I don't know. I got the impression that they don't have a lot of resources, and that could be part of it, that they just don't have the government – for whatever reason, hasn't put a lot of resources towards it. And it could be that they don't have the resources to put towards it. Because every time I kept asking about follow-up, the guy said, we just have too many people.
Yeah, which may just be, the simplest answer and the most truthful answer that he can give.
Yeah.
Well, let me just ask you this. Do you think there's anything... Maybe this is a strange question, but do you think there's anything that the Indians, in any way, is the Indian system, do they do anything better than we do?
I can't think of anything that they would do better. I did notice that a lot of the doctors, the psychiatrists, were trained in England or Britain. Mm-hmm. And so, they pretty much use the same type of medicine protocol that we would use here.
Okay.
So, one hospital was a very large new hospital, a beautiful facility, and they, if you had the very limited income, then you wouldn't pay at all, or if they always have a sliding scale fee.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes treatment affordable for everyone.
Mm-hmm. So that might be one thing. Their system allows more people with less resources to have treatment. I do know about the British, a little bit about the British system, and their philosophy is a little bit more geared towards harm reduction, I think, than in the U.S.
Uh-huh.
So I assume would be reflected in the Indian system?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes.
All right. Well, we're probably pretty close to being out of time, and I want to just ask you if there's any other things that you would like to say in closing, any other thoughts that you have about your experiences in India and the things that you've done and seen?
No, it was just very interesting to go and see the facilities and see the people and actually take a tour and walk in the, you'd call it the hospital wing or the hospital unit where the patients actually were. And so, I got to see everything, and you don't really get to see that. So for me, it was really worth it, even though it was a short trip.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was such a very rich educational and cultural experience to kind of like see behind the walls of what actually happens in a mental health facility and to talk to a psychiatrist about addictions and then to actually go into the cafeteria on the tour and see some of the clients that were there for addictions treatment and look at that 20-bed wing. Mm-hmm. They had a mother and child unit and to actually take a look at that. And I noticed that they had lots and lots of caretakers available within the facility. So that was just all a very, very positive, interesting experience for me.
You really got a firsthand look at it. I guess one last question before we close, and that would be, do you think your experiences in seeing the Indian system will change or has changed the way you do what you do here in the U.S.?
Well, I need to do more with meditation. They did give us a class on meditation there where we were learning to connect the mind and the body. I'd like to get more training in that area and incorporate that more into what I do with the clients.
So you were inspired to go a little further with that. That's great. I think that's a great outcome for you. We're about out of time, so I do want to thank you for coming on tonight, Dr. Elizabeth Nyang. Join us tonight talking about her experiences with treatment. Mental health and substance abuse treatment in India. So thank you for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, Elizabeth. Good evening.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you to our guest tonight, Dr. Elizabeth Nyang, and thank you to all our listeners and studio audience for making us a successful little underground support source for the recovering community. We will email our reminders for next week's show, and as always, try to look at recovery from a wide and open perspective. Remember to check recoveryinternetradio.com for all our archive shows and to sign up for our email reminder list. Remember, too, that we want to hear from you so we know where our listeners are. Contact us via recoveryinternetradio.com or on Twitter at Rick Atwater. And as always, live today, love yourself and your neighbor, and together we'll trudge the happy road to destiny. We hope you enjoyed the show. See you at 7 p.m. next Sunday night.